If I believe that I'm worthy of meaning making, that means I believe every single other person is worthy of meaning making. And that means that everyone should have, deserves equal opportunity and access to meaning making. And that means we all need our baseline fundamental needs met for this physical reality. And we have to begin there as a species, as a humanity, and then build upward. And then not only do we get to work on self-actualization, but we can work on collective actualization. Just because there's one way that we've done things our entire life does not mean that that's the right way to do them, the only way to do them. And actually, if you trace it back through history and lineage and why things started down that line to begin with, it probably had something to do with fear, lack mindset, and someone being afraid that their power was going to be taken away from them. When actually, if we have faith and trust and belief in one another and in the universe, that everything is as it should be, there's really no power to lose because there's no power to hold on to.
Hey, y'all. I'm Reese, and welcome to Making Meaning. Making Meaning is a podcast by the Cohere Collective here to help guide you along your path to make meaning in a way that makes sense for you. And this week, we are doing a quick mid-season check-in to review how it's going, what we're learning so far, and just some key takeaways that I've had and that I've been experiencing from your comments across YouTube and Instagram and TikTok and all of the different places, and hopefully start a conversation about how these episodes are also in conversation with one another, and that meaning making is not just done in isolation, and neither should these episodes be in isolation. So to dive into this mid-season check-in, catch-up, review, I am just going to run through all of our episodes thus far chronologically and name some of the key takeaways that I had, my experience with these different wonderful meaning makers, and then we'll shift into intersections between them, and then also some bigger picture themes that I think we're all going through as a collective. So we'll start micro, go macro, and let this conversation take us where it desires to go. So we are going to start with episode 1 of season 4 that was with the lovely Catherine Hart. Catherine is, if you've listened to the episode, you will know, one of my favorite people in this entire world. Not only is she one of the most profound impacts on my life, because of all that she has taught me, but she is just truly one of the most deeply aligned and connected people that I have ever had the privilege of meeting. And I've told this story before, but I think it just really bears repeating. So the very first day that I met Miss Hart, I was walking into the first day of an acting camp for that summer, and I was 13 years old. I was itty bitty. And I will never forget, after that day of acting camp, it's 4 hours and we had popcorn and Oreos for a snack, and it was a blast. And I knew that acting was going to be a part of my destiny, my life's path, no matter what that looked like. It was like the best day ever. When my parents came to pick me up, I will never forget that Miss Hart kind of pulled me aside and said, "Reese, when you look at the world, you see poetry." Since that moment, I have strived to be that person that Miss Hart saw and to see poetry in everything, all around me, because I do think that there's poetry everywhere. One thing actually that I've been thinking a lot about recently is the definition of the poet. I think that that is a really fascinating archetype in the kind of Jungian sense, but also in this mythological sense of we all have creator in us. We are all ultimately the creator of our own lives and co-creating with the universe and with one another and engaging with each other. But the poet seems to walk this liminal space between the divine and the human. But also,
I deeply believe that human beings are doing that too. So as I was thinking about this, I was like, is every human being just a poet in their own sense? And I think in some way, yes, the same way we all have the different archetypes within us, right? Also, the same way that I conceive of my own idea of spirits or entities or energies as different pieces reflective of me external, or these external things that are being mirrored through some internal discovery, shadow work, therapy piece that I'm needing to do to work through, to process, to become the wholest and truest version of myself. So with all of that being said, I've really been thinking about the poet as creator in and of themselves. I really relate the poet a lot to Nietzsche's work in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, in the hermit figure going up the mountain and being by themselves, talking to themselves, coming up with their own idea of what the meaning of life is, right? This kind of Stephen Hawking theory of everything that the hermit cultivates when they are alone in the cave. And then they light that lantern and come back down to show the light of the lantern, metaphorically, that is, this secret that they have kind of tapped into, this definition of meaning that they have created or cultivated or made for themselves, and show it to the townspeople. And in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche writes, actually, let me pull up the exact quote. Oh, okay, so I'm looking this up, and it's actually the thing that I'm thinking of is one of the aphorisms from The Gay Science, not a direct quote from Thus Spoke Zarathustra, but it's the same myth that he's kind of pulling from. So I'm going to read this aphorism for you. Have you ever heard of the madman who, on a bright morning, lighted a lantern and ran to the marketplace, calling out unceasingly, "I seek God, I seek God"? As there were many people standing about who did not believe in God, he caused a great deal of amusement. "Why, is he lost?" said one. "Has he strayed away like a child?" said another. "Or does he keep himself hidden? Is he afraid of us? Has he taken a sea voyage? Has he immigrated?" the people cried out laughingly, all in a hubbub. The insane man jumped into their midst and transfixed them with his glances. "Where is God gone?" he called out. "I mean to tell you, we have killed him, you and I. We are all his murderers, but how have we done it? How are we able to drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the whole horizon? What did we do when we loosened this earth from its sun? Whither does it now move? Whither do we move? Away from all suns? Do we not dash on unceasingly? Backwards, sideways, forwards, in all directions. Is there still an above and below? Do we not stray as though infinite nothingness? Does not empty space breathe upon us? Has it not become colder? Does not night come on continually, darker and darker? Shall we not have to light lanterns in the morning? Do we not hear the noise of the gravediggers who are burying God? Do we not smell the divine putrefaction? For even gods putrefy. God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we console ourselves, the most murderous of all murderers, the holiest and the mightiest the world has hitherto possessed, has bled to death under our knife? Who will wipe the blood from us? With what water could we cleanse ourselves? What lustrums, what sacred games shall we have to devise? Is not the magnitude of this deed too great for us? Shall we not ourselves have to become gods, merely to seem worthy of it? There never was a greater event, and on account of it, all who are born after us belong to a higher history than any history hitherto. Here, the madman was silent and looked again at his hearers. They also were silent and looked at him in surprise. At last, he threw his lantern on the ground so that it broke in pieces and was extinguished. "I come too early," he then said. "I am not yet at the right time. This prodigious event is still on its way and is traveling. It has not yet reached men's ears. Lightning and thunder need time. The light of the stars need time. Deeds need time, even after they are done, to be seen and heard. This deed is as yet further from them than the furthest star, and yet they have done it. It is further stated that the madman made his way into different churches on the same day, and there intoned his Requiem Aeternam Deo. When led out and called to account, he always gave the reply, "What are these churches now, if they are not the tombs and monuments of God?" So to me, this aphorism almost perfectly describes the poet, the madman. And I think that that is really how I have come to understand the poet, is the one who comes before their time, not necessarily the one who writes poetry. What is poetry, right? How do we define poesis? And I think all human beings are before their own time in a sense, because we are walking at the intersection of our time, right? We as physical beings are existing in space-time, in the 3D world, but to take a step forward into space while being beings that operate in the imaginal, we are kind of creating reality as we go. So you must be going before your time, but as soon as you land in your time, it is there, and it is past, and you are already early for it. That sounds insane, but it's making sense in my head. I hope that reading this aphorism kind of helps with how I'm contextualizing that. And I really love the imagery of the lantern, that he shatters it and the light snuffs out when he says, I have come too early. This deed has not yet come to pass. It needs time. There is something about these divine imaginal realities that we are trying to conjure in a physical form, in a physical manifestation, that requires time. Manifestation is the imaginal in the 3D. So as poets, we are also magicians, right? Like casting spells into this present moment. And I think that this aphorism is a really beautiful example of what happens when we let the impossibility of paradox get to us. And I think one overarching theme that I want to come back to at the end, once we've gone through all of the different episodes chronologically, is this idea of nihilism versus hope, of destruction versus creation, and how I think that a lot of thinkers throughout history that have touched on this element of life that I am very passionate about tend to fall into this, like, God is dead and we have murdered him piece of the puzzle. And I tend to fall into this, God is alive and we have borne him side. And while I think both are true, I think one of those, both iterations feel very different to say and to hear and to conjure into reality, right? So all of that to say, Miss Hart being the one who first piqued my interest in the idea of creativity and creation to begin with, because that's what acting really was for me. It was also a deep study of other human beings and the human experience, which is then what I went on to study in my journey through academia. But also, I think part of why I just love Miss Hart and I love this episode is that all of these really high order concepts so often feel so out of touch from our day-to-day life. And acting is one of those things that grounds it down into this reality, at least for me, right? Like, the role of the artist is in some sense to try and physically capture the divine. And I think that that's what really great actors do. They allow us to feel seen in this way that is deeply human and powerful, to know that, oh, this thing that is so unique and special and inalienable about me is also this thing that is universal and connective to every single other human being. And I think it is that aspect of the human experience that performance taps into, and also speaks to Miss Hart's passion for justice and activism and wanting to make the world a better place. Because when you've spent your life studying both what makes every single human being special and unique and important, and also how that piece is the thing that connects and unites all of us, it is borderline impossible to not become an activist, to not be someone who wants to generate safety and opportunity and decency for all human beings. I think that Miss Hart's episode is a really, really great place to start this season, both because it was a beautiful full circle moment for me, but also because Miss Hart's work really does sit at the intersection of creation so powerfully, in the sense that it is bridging the divide between trying to speak to this bigger aspect of humanity while also speaking to the lived realities that we all face every day. The sun is slowly going down as I record, so don't mind me if the lighting shifts for my YouTube viewers. But on to episode 2 with Kelly Windorf. And in this episode, the piece that just so struck me was Kelly's willingness to talk about the negative side of spiritual communities, which I never really want to be the one to point out quote-unquote bad parts of things that I think are beneficial, right? So like we see this happening online where people will say like the left is eating each other because instead of waiting for people to be perfect activists, like why are we tearing each other down? We need to be doing the work to actually connect on our shared goal and vision and put our energy in the direction of tearing down systems and structures that are deeply harmful, not towards tearing each other down on small, minute differences. But one thing that I've really come to understand the nuance of, or try to understand the nuance of, hold the nuance of, and that I think what Kelly spoke to in this episode is that we have to do both. And yes, it can get counterproductive to constantly be critiquing spaces that are largely positive and beneficial. But at the same time, if we are trying to create a new world, essentially, create new spaces and systems that are open and liberating and empowering, we have to be actively creating those in the image that we want them to exist in now, while also tearing down the structures that prevent that from happening. We can't just tear down these systems and structures and then get to work building this other thing. We also can't just build this other thing and hope that all along the way, these bad structures will dissolve. But we need to be doing both. And it makes me think of, I've been quoting this so much recently, but it's because it's so powerful and so juicy. Audre Lorde's quote, "We cannot use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house." And I think there's some really, there's some medicine in that, in the sense that we must be constructing the new thing that we want to construct so that we have shelter before the master's house is completely torn down, right? We need something before a storm comes and there isn't any shelter at all. But in this new structure that we're building, that is also where we can, to belabor this metaphor, start a blacksmith area little pocket or a forgery or build these new tools to be able to dismantle the master's house. But something had to be created for those new tools to be created as well. So in order for destruction to occur, we must be creating something. And, but also, no one who is not an early adopter of the new creation is going to leave the known safety, even if it's a known hell, for the unknown heaven that could be this new structure. So all of that to say, Kelly speaking to the difficulties and negativities that can exist in a lot of spiritual spaces, I think is a very necessary conversation and spoke truth to a lot of my felt experience that is like, Why are some of the most quote-unquote love and light people I know also some of the most toxic and nasty in a very like real sense? And it's like, whoa, that should not be the case. The same way Christians that are supposed to be the most loving and open and, Jesus-like oftentimes are some of the most hurtful and harmful individuals that exist in this world. So what are we to do with that? And as someone who is a member of a lot of like spiritual, esoteric-y spaces, I think it's our duty as we are crafting this new shelter, this new house, that we do so with integrity and alignment with how we want that to look. And if we're tearing down the master's house and these old structures because it's not safe, because it's not productive, well, we sure as hell don't want to be building a lack of safety and productivity, but inclusivity and expansiveness into this new shelter either. And how often are we just revolting to create something new, quote unquote new, that's actually just mirroring the same old issue, but in different language? We actually need to understand the heart of what it is that we're doing, not just regurgitating the nice words that we hear people say. I was talking with Lauren about this on the other podcast, The Unwritten Aesthetic, and how as philosophers, it's really important that we don't just regurgitate jargon, but we really understand what we're saying. And it's really easy when you confront a dense text to read a known popular analysis of it and just be like, okay, yeah, that is what Heidegger was saying. That is what Jung was saying. These really like particularly obtuse authors are trying to communicate. But that's not really what philosophy is. Philosophy is digging into the text yourself. And even if your analysis is the first of its kind, is completely different than these quote unquote trusted analyses, it doesn't mean yours is wrong. And actually, yours is probably really needed, because these dense texts, I mean, like Nietzsche too, there's so many different things that can be pulled from the mass of philosophical and literary canon that every single person's take on it will add a layer to what we can learn from it. And to just echo the analyses that we've been told are the quote-unquote correct ones is, to me, mirroring the flaws of the master's house, to combine like 30 different metaphors. So I really appreciated this episode with Kelly, and I just felt so seen in so much of what we were talking about, which was, it's always a good feeling, but also there's just always a moment when you're talking with someone and you just click in and it's like, okay, yeah, we're going somewhere really good with this one. Hello, everyone. It's Reese from the future interrupting Reese from the past. Time is an illusion anyways. To ask you how you're enjoying this episode so far. Have you had any major insights, key takeaways? And let me know in the comments down below. Do you think Zarathustra actually was a madman, is a poet, and what the poet archetype means to you? I would love to hear it. I'm also just briefly going to ask you to subscribe. Give us a like, a 5-star rating, or a review wherever you are listening or watching. That is the best way to support Making Meaning, to support the Cohere Collective, and to support me in doing this work. And if you do comment down below what the archetype of poet means to you, you may hear your comment shouted out in a future episode of Making Meaning. Okay, back to me, I guess. My next episode was with Abigail Rebecca, and what a fun episode. Abigail does such a beautiful job in all of her work of bringing play to the picture, despite having such a hefty and weighty backstory. If you haven't listened to the episode yet, of course, I would love for you to listen to all of these episodes. But Abigail grew up in a cult, and now helps women create their own businesses in alignment with their human design. And
I am pretty new to human design still, but it's certainly one of those pieces of this esoteric, occulty kind of world that I dabble into that really interests me, and Abigail's approach to it being one of play and this marriage between the dark parts of life, but also the light parts of life, just felt really useful to me. Because so often, again, going back to what I was talking about at the very beginning around the Nietzsche discussion, so often when people come from darkness or darkness, I think we have an instinct to say that darkness is bad and lightness is good. And there's something more complex and nuanced about how darkness and lightness actually rely upon one another. So with all of that, I think the more darkness that you create space for in your life, actually the more space for play and joy and shine you allow in too. It just becomes expansive. The brighter a light, the deeper and longer a shadow it casts. And I think that Abigail's story is a really beautiful reflection of that. And I loved diving into human design and learning a little bit more about mine through the course of hearing from her about human design. And it's so funny because, you know, I was talking about the hermit and the archetype of the poet earlier. And in my mind, those all feel very Virgo-esque to me. And Virgo is my sun sign. The hermit in the tarot is a card that is associated with the sign of Virgo. And because of that and the connection to Zarathustra, I've always thought of Virgo very much as this like poet archetype in astrology. And while human design pulls on astrology, it certainly is not the same. And Virgos tend to be, I think, pretty relatively well-liked as far as signs go. But apparently, I did not know this until I dived more into human design. I'm a 5-1, and that is like the human design archetype that people are like, stay away from. They're not bad, but like maybe more difficult. And so it was just interesting to see the different reflections of myself in all of these different traditions. And when you discover throughout your life different tools for self-discovery, because I think for so long I was working from a paradigm of just my sun sign too within astrology, and now I've been learning more about like the entirety of my chart and working from my rising sign. And growing up, I was very much consumed with needing to be liked, needing to be understood, needing to be good and approved of publicly and externally. And while certainly I'm still working on it, a really big part of that work for me right now, around the time that my paradigm with astrology is shifting, but also around the time that I discovered human design, is working on being okay with being the villain in someone else's story. Being okay with someone thinking that I'm mean, welcoming being misunderstood, and even saying all of those things like spikes my heart rate. Because one, intuitively, like who enjoys those things, right? And our psychology is wired to tell us no bad, scary, be accepted by your fellow human beings, by the tribe, because if you're rejected, that means death. But we know that that's not true anymore. And how can rejection actually look like liberation now is the paradigm that I'm trying to learn from as well. And discovering my human design at this time was a really powerful mirror. So go check out this episode and go check out your human design too. Episode 4 with my lovely dear friend, Loveth Hurd. What a powerful, powerful episode. I'm always so just humbled and astounded at the vulnerability that people gift me and the Cohere Collective and the Making Meaning podcast with. There is like straight up magic in your story. And for people to come onto this podcast and allow it to be the avenue through which they tell their story for the first time is also a radical act of honesty and self-acceptance and self-love that they are putting on display for other people to witness very publicly. And that in and of itself is extremely vulnerable. But they are also allowing people to learn from that. And that is just like so, so brave, like just fucking brave. To me, that's like, that's coherence right there. Like it is such a lived act of owning coherence. And it is just the biggest privilege in the world that people trust not just the spaces that I've created to tell and share and own their story, but me to help steward the space for them to do so. It's the greatest, greatest privilege. And I don't always know when we're going to go there, but this episode with Loveth, we absolutely did. And my word, is their story just one that we all need to learn from? And biggest takeaway here is just Loveth's depiction of refusing to forget the self is something that I think we all need to learn from. I'm pretty sure they said, I'm refusing to forget the self, but also I must remember myself. And both of those things, even though they sound like mirror images of each other, I think they have very distinct nuances to them. And we should be able to hold both of them because of those slight differences, that not only are we refusing to forget the self in this radical act against externalities that tell us to forget the self, but also we are owning the remembrance of the self too. Going back to something that we have always known that rests inside of us, that goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, right? This thing that is so particular about the human experience, that is unique to us, but also that which makes us whole and united and connected to one another, because no one could possibly understand our subjective experience of the human experience, but also we know that everyone is having their own human experience in this very multiplicitous way. And that is just worth remembering. And don't you dare forget it. Do not. And on top of that, I think Loveth's episode is also a beautiful example of how these esoteric concepts and bigger concepts about self-growth and self-discovery and self-love that feel talked about a lot in the zeitgeist right now, right? Like we're very much in the self-love, self-care era, which is great in a lot of ways. I have some mixed feelings about the languaging around it, which if you've listened to me for any time, you'll probably know. But Loveth's experience and story speaks to the need to ground that into life, into practicality, and the implications of self-love on how we live and treat one another. And it really embodies coherence in that it's not just about my relationship with the self. It must be also how I walk in this world in my relationship with other people. And those things are also deeply connected. And you know, it's the RuPaul, if you can't love yourself, how in the hell are you going to love somebody else? But also, if you are not loving yourself, you cannot, or I'm sorry, I misspoke. If you are not loving others, you cannot love the self. It just doesn't work. There is something fundamental to humanity and to our relationship to one another that just like, it doesn't vibe and connect. One thing that I came to in my thinking when I was still living in Italy was this idea that it's actually impossible for anyone to not live in accordance with the golden rule, that you will always treat other people the way that you want to be treated. And in using the word want, I'm meaning this in a more subconscious sense, that the way that you treat yourself is actually how we do end up treating other people. Because the people who harm others and stifle others and restrict others and take liberties and protections and rights away from other people, I deeply believe are the people who hate themselves the most. because they have so fundamentally ignored this piece of themselves that we're talking about, this inner spark, this coherence, this meaning that rests right, you know, in your soul, in your chi, in your heart, in your spirit, in your energy, in your brain, in your mind, whatever you want to call it, your consciousness. I'm going to call it coherence. That's my word for it. But those people who have so deeply denied that about themselves are the only ones who could ever treat other people like that, because they have absolutely ripped their humanity away from themselves. And I think that's why this act of owning your inherent worth, knowing that your coherence deserves to take up space, is so revolutionary, because of what it also calls us to do in how we treat other people, in how we engage in community and structures of governance. And Loveth's story is just like bang on about that. And I think that's a story that we need to be telling and listening to more and more and more. My next episode was with Jules Kuroda, and this episode was so powerful in how it bridged the gap between science and spirituality. And that's something I tend to talk about a lot, and I think that that language feels a little dualistic for me now in my current understanding of like my worldview and the paradigms that I work from. But it is still so important, especially in framing my work to other people, because it adds such a beautiful entryway for, yeah, when you're talking about God, that's what I mean by energy field. Or when you're talking about the atheistic sense of atoms, that's also what I'm talking about when I use the word God, you know? And even though it's certainly much bigger and broader than just science and spirituality are the same thing, it gives us a really nice shorthand with which to have these conversations with one another. And of course, it's like, okay, yeah, we are talking about something slightly different when we're talking about atoms versus God, but also in a deeper, realer sense, not really on my worldview. And there was actually one article that Dennis, my co-host on Bow Down, the other podcast that we have here at the Cohere Collective, he sent to me, and it was about the astrology of Uranus moving into Gemini this year. And I remember in it, there was a sentence that said something about the shift in this energy that is about information and information dissemination that was seeing, again, let me actually pull up the quote. That will be helpful. So this sentence is talking about the transit of Uranus moving into Gemini, but I think it reflects outward and expands into a lot of other important things that I'm talking about. Think of this transit as an assault on mental complacency. It shatters old fixed beliefs and replaces them with a cascade of new, often contradictory information. It's like having your internal library with all its neatly organized shelves hit by a cyclone. You might find a volume of quantum physics shelved next to a book on ancient witchcraft and suddenly realize they're talking about the same thing. Because they are. And oh, does that not just give you goosebumps that it's like, yeah, they are. And like, ultimately, that is, I think, something that I really nerd out about, that I try to systematize, but I'd like to add a little bit more structure to in my own worldview and paradigm, because there's just something so magical to me about like the sacred geometry of the world and how everything moves in gyres. And it's like, of course, if our energy is moving in that same form, then we are going to return to these same cycles as a pattern of all of this energy. And that's going to also be reflected in human history and the cycles that humans and civilizations go through too. And it just is fascinating and like endlessly beautiful to me, and the most random and unrandom thing that could possibly exist. And what Jules's work really speaks to, especially in her book, The Innate Self, is the subjective aspect of this experience and how we all have this piece of that magic in us, but similarly reminds us how to expand it out into the universe around us. The next episode is with the lovely Carolyn Kraft, and sometimes I'll find people's work online and I'll reach out to them and I'm like, hey, do you want to do an episode? Like, I think this could be really cool. We could talk about this and this and this. And, you know, not everyone responds back, or sometimes it'll be a no, or sometimes it'll be, I don't quite have time right now, reach out again. And it's all beautiful and perfect and I completely understand it. But I was just so stoked when Carolyn said yes, because I just really love her approach to this work. And I think it's one that is so important and necessary, but it's also one that people like to think that they're doing, but they really don't do it well. So Carolyn's work, being primarily philosophically based, but also she talks about a lot of political issues and socioeconomic systems and structures that we all exist within, and kind of hot button topics. A lot of people like to say that they're approaching these from an unbiased, nuanced, complex way and wanting to help you maintain your true, like, analysis, thinking, and thought pattern with it from a place of your own ethics, integrity, and values. One, kind of impossible to do that perfectly and have a conversation around that without some of your own bias slipping in there. But man, Carolyn gets pretty damn close. And I think there can be a debate about how comfortable different people feel doing work like that. I know for me, I don't think I would be able to have a channel like Carolyn's, because I do feel, just for me personally, that I have some duty to own my belief system in terms of what I think is really right and really wrong, and to kind of fight for that publicly with my voice. And not to say that that's not what Carolyn is doing, but I think her approach is different in the sense that she is totally locking into complete neutrality so that people are forced to confront what their actual beliefs, values, and baseline thinking is. And that is where so much of this work has to start, has to begin, is with confronting your baseline beliefs. And if you don't know what those are, you're not going to be informed by reading the media. You're not going to be able to learn from scrolling on TikTok, no matter how informed or unbiased or educated the people that you are listening to are. It's impossible to separate what you really think from the bombardment of information we all receive every day. And I think Carolyn's work is a really beautiful place to start to try and understand these issues and just see how they hit you and see how they feel and start there. And I think it's a really powerful way to remind people to tap back into their humanity in doing this work, especially in a politically volatile time. I think it's a really important space to have. And again, I don't think that's the space that I feel called to create, but I am really, really glad that Carolyn is creating that space and that she's the one that's creating it. I think that I just have so much respect for everything that she's doing. And it was really cool to also talk to a fellow young woman who's doing things like this about that experience too, because it's certainly interesting. The next episode was with Anthony Avignano, and what a synchronistic episode. Before we hopped on this call, I did not know that Anthony was literally living in Florence, and we recorded this episode, I think, a week after I moved back to the States from living in Florence. And so immediately I was just like, that's weird and wild. Do I need to go back to Florence? Which, one, I will be eventually, and of course I need to. It's the most magical place in the world. But it was just like, whoa. What a synchronicity. And then the little things just kept popping up in our conversation for me that was just like, I've been thinking about that. Oh my gosh. And that relates to this thing over here. And that relates to this other thing that I was talking about with a friend. And that relates to this thing that I was talking about with my therapist. And that relates to this thing that I was talking about with my dad. And like,
just all of the spider webbing. I don't know if you can see it on my face in this episode, but I really felt like the woman in that meme with all the different math equations going. Because that was just so what this episode felt like for me very personally. And it was so powerful, as is Anthony's story and work. And biggest takeaway here is just the beauty of the breath. And again, I kind of just touched on this, but the cycles that exist all around us that kind of mirror and refract inward and outwardly, it's kind of the turtles all the way down concept. But the fact that we, as human beings, as physical creatures that exist in nature, are constantly mirroring the same cycles that we exist within, it's just like, what? It's just an absolute miracle. And the innate power of the breath is truly embodying in a very mental sense, because we know how deeply the mind connects to our breath, but also in a deeply physical sense, the cycle of death and rebirth that happens every second for us. It is both the thing that we think about the least, but also the thing that asks us to call our attention to it in every moment and to be inspired, to inspire, right? Is both to breathe life into someone else and into the self. And we were talking about earlier how the self is a mirror of the other and vice versa. Like, you can just see how all of these ripple effects cycle. And to me, an inhale and an exhale is like the sun rising and setting. It's what our earth does every day. It's like the turning of the season. It's in nature needing to die and be reborn every year. It's everything around us all the time. No matter how good humans get at engineering, at innovation, at creation, at anything, we will still be dealing with physical reality, because ultimately we are physical beings, at least in this instantiation, in this moment. And cars will always hit a year where they stop working. Houses will always eventually be overtaken by nature. Like, everything we create ultimately will, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, go back to the way it once was. And there is something so grief-riddenly beautiful about that. In talking about this, I want to clarify that I don't think that that means we should be trying to fight these cycles either. I think that this should be a lesson in how we work with the world around us. And when you hear people talking about ancient cultures and civilizations and peoples that, you know, organized differently and did operations differently and thought about the earth differently and the world differently, we don't really dive into all that much quite what that means, really. But one thing, as I've been trying to study those things in a deeper and deeper level, and not just like, oh yeah, Indigenous Americans didn't think that anyone really owned the land. So when colonizers came from Europe and colonized the Americas, they were like, okay, well, you don't think you own the land. I own the land now. And it's like, that is true in some sense, but it's a very surface level of this understanding, because it wasn't just that Native Americans didn't think that anyone owned the land, and we think of it differently as settler colonials, practitioners of settler colonialism, however you should say that, but that they actually had a deep and rich relationship with the living world as members and participants in the living world, and that there are innovations and changes and technologies that are created from and for and with the living world that worked very well, that were beautifully simplistic in that it did exactly what you needed it to do.
And the genius of that, the sacredness of that proficiency in conciseness in a physical item. And I just suppose all that to say, in talking about these cycles of death and rebirth, I just want to emphasize how when we talk about like returning to a more ancient understanding of the way things are and should be, and the way that our relationship with nature and the living world should expand and contract, it's not to say that there's no such thing as innovation and as growth. It's just that it looks more like partnership than dominion, just because there's one way that we've done things our entire life, our lives, and one way that our ancestors did them for most of their lives does not mean that that's the right way to do them, the only way to do them. And actually, if you trace it back through history and lineage and why things started down that line to begin with, it probably had something to do with fear, lack mindset, and someone being afraid that their power was going to be taken away from them. When actually, if we have faith and trust and belief in one another and in the universe, that everything is as it should be, there's really no power to lose because there's no power to hold on to. No one can take something from you that isn't yours, so there's nothing to really be afraid of anyways. Again, it's a very simplistic depiction of this, and I'm still certainly trying to educate myself and learn more about this, but the breath is a beautiful example of it, and I actually think this ties really nicely into our next episode with Elspeth Hay, and we talked about why the hell we don't eat acorns anymore and how that ties into colonialism and colonization and the need for this ancestral healing. And I think this is just like confirmation from Elspeth that this absolutely is a conversation that we need to be having, that we are having, whether we are aware of it or not. So we should call our awareness to it so that we can be in dialogue with our history, with our ancestors, with the living world in a intentional and aware way, as opposed to just repeating cycles that we don't want to be repeating. Which cycles are we repeating that we don't want to be repeating? And which cycles are we repeating that we should be repeating? It's all about cycles. The next episode was with K. Margaret Solorio, and this was such a fun episode. There are just certain times where I get on my soapbox about the meaning of life, and I just really want to be the annoying person at the dinner party that says, why? Okay, and why? And why that? And why again? Which sometimes I feel like I sound like an annoying six-year-old, but other times it's like we really do get somewhere really good with that continued line of questioning. And I think that that's a really powerful line of questioning to have with yourself too. If you don't really know why you feel a certain way and you're trying to figure out maybe what wound lies under that or what piece of yourself that you are wanting to learn more about, just keep asking why until you get to something that feels like a root, and eventually it'll probably come up again, cycles once more, and you'll get to ask why some more and heal another dimension of it or bring awareness to another dimension of it. And I also really love how K. Margaret's work deals in place, because that's something that in my research around this colonization and colonialism and all of these different cycles that we are participants in, it's something that a lot of my research has really brought up for me. And there's an animist way of thinking that says that there is no such thing as space. Everything is place. And I think that is really the uniting thread between K. Margaret's work and Elspeth Hay's work, truly, is how do we as human beings engage with place? And that every place we are in, there are attending spirits to that place. There is an energy to that place. There is a person to that place, depending on the worldview you're working from, right? But with engaging with something that is alive and nuanced, treating it with the respect and dignity of place as opposed to space, I think is really important and powerful. And last but not least, episode 10 this season was with Shara Goswick. And I met Shara at the podcast movement convention that I went to. It was my first podcast convention, and it was the first time I was at anything with a creator badge. And it was just such a fun, lovely experience, but also so lovely to meet Shara. And once again, the humbling nature of people trusting me with their story and trusting this space and this community with that story will always be novel to me and will always just make me feel so grateful, because ultimately the reason why all of this work together culminates in the word coherence is because even though we all have a different relationship to the numinous, to the imaginal, to something beyond, and we are quote unquote spiritual beings having a physical experience, the thing that we in our current modern mindset cling to is what we can prove as reality. And we cannot move beyond our physical reality in a Maslow's hierarchy of needs sense if our physical needs have not been met. Even though there are higher order things that do beg for our attention and bear and need our attention, we have to begin with food, shelter, physical safety, emotional safety, community and connection. That's where we have to begin. And we can't do any of this other work if we don't have that. It is a privilege, the biggest privilege in the world, to be able to do this work. And therefore, we have to acknowledge this physical reality. And that's something that so many spiritual and philosophical communities and works and histories completely negate. And that's why justice has to be a part of this. Because if I believe that I'm worthy of meaning making, that means I believe every single other person is worthy of meaning making. And that means that everyone should have, deserves the equal opportunity and access to meaning making. And that means we all need our baseline fundamental needs met for this physical reality. And we have to begin there as a species, as a humanity, and then build upward. And then not only do we get to work on self-actualization, but we can work on collective actualization and what that looks like. But none of it fucking matters if there are people who are starving. None of it fucking matters if people still don't have clean drinking water. None of it fucking matters if genocides continue happening in this world. We live in a physical world. And that is the most pressing reality at hand. Not to say that all of your work should center on this one most immediate thing, right? Like, there's different levels of immediacy and different nuances and complexities that we have to hold when it comes to taking care of the self and others, of course. But that's why coherence is a collective. And that's also why coherence has to integrate justice. And that's also why we make such space for this physical reality, for space, not space, place, for other human beings, for the physical body, for our physical wellness, our mental health, for community and connection and relationships. Because it is only with and of those things that the numinous can also be called in, and vice versa. It is all in divine dialogue and communion with one another. To bring it back to Shara's story, I think even though it's probably pretty obvious that Shara and I share a different worldview and religious system from one another, I have so much respect for the way that she lives her life informed by this view, by the values that her religious system espouses. Because ultimately, the cognitive dissonance and lack of coherence, the incoherence that so many individuals have, I think, is what causes so much injustice. It goes back to what I was talking about in relationship to Carolyn's episode. You have to understand your baseline values first and then work outward from there. And Shara really understands her baseline values. And I think that's really allowed her to heal in a really beautiful and powerful way. Because how do you heal something working from a paradigm that's unclear? Do you even consider the thing you're trying to heal from a wound if you don't know your values? What is a wound to you, right? Like all of these things. This season has been so, so powerful for me so far, and I am so excited for it to continue. The overarching themes here, I think, are really clear. A connection to the cycles of the broader world and how those cycles mirror on all different levels and kind of fractal images throughout history, throughout space and place, throughout the individual and the collective, and at different levels of experience, from the breath all the way up to the solar system, to systems of governance and economics, to systems of spirituality. And that this conversation needs to be had on all of these different levels in order for coherence to truly be the conversation that we're having. And maybe that's not the conversation you want to be having. It's the one I want to be having, because I think it's the one that I found that allows all of these different elements to be equally as important and vested, and us to be vested in all of them equally. If that makes sense. I hope that makes sense. But with all of these different levels of this mirroring that happens with these cycles, the last thing that I wanted to come back to was the difficulty that I have and the change that I am striving to make with and in philosophical and spiritual communities. And in humanity as a whole, I suppose. I think there is a really big pattern of individuals trying to break us free of dichotomies, of individuals trying to change the way that we think about the world. But those individuals that we see then offer a stagnant new dichotomy of their own. That, sure, offers some growth and some insight and pushes the needle forward, but still resettles us into a certain right and wrong that I just resist, a certain hierarchy that I think at a certain point doesn't serve. So, when we think of people like Nietzsche, who write books like The Antichrist, that I think is extremely powerful and everyone should read, regardless of your religious worldview. I also want us to think about how we can read that in tandem with the Bible and vice versa. And I think that there are a lot of people who would say one or the other is right or wrong, which fundamentally I just kind of disagree with. But then even further, these deep thinkers like Nietzsche that are trying to offer something new do so in a counter way, do so by saying God is dead. And like I said at the beginning, I don't just want to hold that God is dead and we have killed him. I also want to hold that God is alive and we have birthed him. And I think both of those things have to be true in this yin-yang sense. Similarly with, I've been really diving into Carl Jung's work recently, and he had this deep psychotic episode that he wrote the Red Book during, and the Red Book is deeply fascinating. Again, I highly recommend it. But I don't think that we necessarily need to have a psychotic break to have a connection with the divine. And it kind of goes back to some of these archetypes around like the starving artist? And is there a certain sense in which desperation and intensity of feeling and emotion cultivates something really powerful in the human as creator? Yes, absolutely. But we need to also be able to hold that with, you can also have powerful insights and take care of yourself. And actually, you probably should be taking care of yourself because you're a human being deserving of care. And I just think for so long, even those that are trying to bring us towards nuance, then somehow, like right at the end, make this right turn back into stagnation. And perhaps part of that is just the nature of discursive language, of texts that are printed and aren't breathing. And maybe it's actually impossible to create a theory or a paradigm or a system that is ever evolving. But I hope that that's what I've done and will continue to do and evolve with the Coherence Matrix and with the Cohere Collective. So yeah, God is dead and we have killed him, but also God is alive and we have birthed her. I really enjoyed this recap. I feel like I've gone a little bit off the deep end here in the second half of the episode. My brain is getting a little, like I said, into spaghetti territory. And I think I'm ready for another sip of my coffee and probably some water and maybe some protein too. But it's always just such a joy to reflect back on this beautiful work that I get to do. So thank you for being here. And thank you for being a part of it. Thank you all so very much for being here today. I mentioned having gratitude for several of these guests, and I just want to re-underline how grateful I am to all of them for coming on and sharing their time and energy and wisdom and meaning-making with me. Truly, this is my favorite thing in the world to do, and it brings me so much joy. And I also want to extend that gratitude to you, dear listener, because if I've said it once, I've said it a million times, and I will continue saying it till the cows come home. My favorite part of making meaning is the meaning that you make out of this, because it makes different meaning when it hits your ears, because it becomes something different when you engage with it. So thank you for being here. Thank you for being you. Thank you for being my part of making meaning. My favorite part of making meaning. I told y'all my brain is going off the deep end right now. But truly, it's fabulous. You're fabulous. You are a miracle. And I can't wait for the rest of the season with you. A big thank you to Nicole O. Stryker for making Meaning's art and podcast cover. You can find her on Instagram at Nicole O. Creates and Nicole O. Design. A big thank you to Tristan Morgan for making Meaning's theme music. You can find him on Instagram at Tristan Morgan. If you are interested in working with me to find and pursue your purpose, you can do so over at www.thecoherecollective.com and learn more. Click on Coherent Design and see how I work with people to help them find and pursue their purpose and make meaning. And if you were like, yeah, I do want to start thinking about my values and life and what does this actually mean to me, and then build coherence out from there, that's what I help people do. So go learn more and reach out to me. Follow the Cohere Collective everywhere that there is social media, all at the Cohere Collective, and subscribe wherever you may be listening or watching. Leave us a like, a 5-star rating, a review, and a comment down below. It's the best way to support me, to support the Cohere Collective, to support the Making Meaning podcast and this work that I am trying to do of spreading coherence and helping everyone in this world live life a little more meaningfully every single day. Okay, I believe I'm losing my mind. That's all I have for you here today. I am so grateful for you for being here. Last but not least, actually, that is not all that I have. We have just started a new newsletter called The Muse Letter that brings you weekly insights for cultivating coherence. I put all of the new content that the Cohere Collective has put out that week in the newsletter, so you will never miss an episode of anything. But also, I add in songs that go with that week's theme, and memes, and quotes, and I write a little essay, and there's recommended research and reading and other podcast episodes that aren't just from me for further research, and there's journal prompts and exercises that you can do and all sorts of things like that. So if you're like, yes, I definitely want to dive into this work, but I'm not sure where to start and I don't know if I want to, you know, do one-on-one work or anything like that, just go subscribe. See if you like it. It's free. And it's like an exclusive little intentional community via email inbox that we can have a deeper conversation about. Okay, now that's all I have for you. Thank you again so very much for being here. And as always, I hope you feel like you are living more coherently. Until next time, love.